it's time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here, and back with us, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David's an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. David, good to see you.
Very nice to see you, too. Thank you.
And Jamie Knack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. And Jamie, good to see you as well.
And it's great to hear your voice, Larry. Thanks for having us back.
Well, we'll talk with them about baby wild animals. We'll also hear about Keeping Wildlife Wild Week and the latest Conservation Congress meeting. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Let us know the animals you're seeing in your neighborhood this month. What do you want to know about Wisconsin's many species of wild animals? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. Let's talk about those baby animals to begin with this time of the year. What are some examples of Wisconsin animals that give birth during the springtime, Jamie?
Sure. So right now, we have a female fox that's been running around our house. So I know she has a litter somewhere. She is nursing. So we know that litter is at least on the ground. And certainly it's time for squirrels to have their first litters, and lots of other, birds nesting at this point in time. So we try to get the word out around March, April, each spring to start to prepare people for encounters with wildlife as the weather gets warmer and folks are out and about, and to prepare them for, what they might encounter and how to make decisions on whether that baby animal needs assistance or is doing exactly what that species does. So it can be quite unusual for wildlife in that a lot of times mother or their parents are not necessarily nearby, which is quite different than what we're used to with human babies.
Yeah, well, they need to get out and get some food for themselves and probably also get some food for their young.
Yeah, absolutely. And Larry, it's pretty timely. This is the week of Keep Wildlife Wild Week, so April 1st through the 5th. And the week is kicking off, but I've been involved with judging a poster contest for 4th through 6th graders. And we just announced the poster winners. So those are available on the Department of Natural Resources website. This has been a partnership since 2014, trying to get the word out through Keeping Wildlife Wild, partnership between the DNR, wildlife rehabilitators in the state, and the Division of Extension at UW-Madison. So there is now a resource library. There are educational materials, all supporting the idea of keeping wildlife wild. So if we have any 4th to 6th grade classroom teachers home today with the snow, go to the DNR's website, type in Keep Wildlife Wild in the keyword search, and take a look. There's a PowerPoint and some learning, lesson plans as well, and other supporting materials. We'd love to have that begin to get incorporated into classrooms.
And there are some kind of negative effects of helping a wild baby animal, are there not?
Yeah, so there's a lot of reasons why we don't want to intervene unless that baby or adult animal is truly injured, is truly abandoned, is diseased, is in dire need of help from a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. But reasons why we don't want to take animals from the wild and make them pets include the stress that encounter when wild animals encounter humans, and we need to think about our domestic pets as well, is highly stressful for them, can cause them health problems and even death. We are not capable of caring for them in terms of the very specialized diets that many wild animals need. There's also concern about diseases and parasites, some of which that are transmissible to domestic animals and even humans in some cases. And we don't want to habituate wild animals. So we don't want to have that repeated contact. It makes it much harder for them to survive if you do relocate them or reintroduce them. And it's illegal in most cases. So most wild animals are protected under state and federal laws, and they cannot be taken from the wild or possessed unless you are authorized to do so in the case of a wildlife rehabilitator. So there's kind of this 24-hour rule that a citizen has to be able to take a wild animal and get it transferred to the appropriate licensed individuals. And again, these are in cases where that animal is bleeding, has a broken leg, is for sure orphaned, you know, those sorts of situations. So
Gary in the town of Ween has, I think, a little story for us and about an encounter with a young animal. Gary, hi.
Hi, good morning, Larry and crew. Always great to listen to the show. My older brother and I were fishing this stretch of trout water up north, and it's one of our favorites. And he was about 50 feet ahead of me, and all of a sudden he started waving his hand and pointing. And here there were two cub bears right on the edge of this rapids playing in the water. And so we were watching that for a little bit, and here there's about a 12-foot embankment going off to where it would plateau, and here up on the top of that was Mama. And she must have caught wind of one of us because she gave a snort, and them two little cubs tried to get up that embankment as fast as they could, and it was quite comical.
Gary, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You know, David, that's the kind of if you see some cubs, you don't want to get between the cubs and Mama.
No, you do not, for sure. And yes, as long as you're observing from a safe distance, that is a fun thing to watch. But as the old adage says, anytime you're in an area where you have predators, you don't have to outrun the predator. You just have to outrun the slowest member of your party.
There you go. David in Fredonia, we'll go to you. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. So last July, we had a big storm at our house, windstorm, and two baby mourning doves fell out of their nests onto the ground. One died and the other survived. So my wife took it in. It just barely started having feathers on it. The wife took it in, and we started feeding it. And it stayed with us in the house for about 2 weeks. My wife would bring it outside here and there because the parents kept hanging around the area where the birds fell. And all of a sudden, the parents started picking on that baby mourning dove, pulling all its hair out of its head. And so we were not putting it out as much. And finally, when it was time to fly, we let it go, obviously, and it's hung around at our house ever since. But the other mourning doves are ostracizing it. They're picking on them, pushing them away from the food. Is there something that we can do to, like, un-ostracize?
Jamie, let's go back to you.
Sure. So just if you're ever in that situation again, this is a great opportunity to just, you know, hey, what could we do if we find a nest with nestlings on the ground? If you could even create an artificial nest, you could take a margarine tub, you could take a basket that berries come in, line it with some grasses, and then use zip ties or anything that you can think of to fasten it back to the branch nearest where the nest was. Or if the nest is still intact, you can place them directly into the nest. There's always the legend that once you touches baby nestlings, that the mother will not return to the nest. And that is a myth. And I think it's probably something people told their kids so the kids wouldn't touch baby birds. But you can go ahead and pick up those nestlings, put them in that artificial nest, and put that right back on that branch with the hopes that mother will come back to it. And that would be the most ideal situation. After that, it probably would be best to, again, because we can't possess those birds for more than 24 hours, is to call the wildlife rehabilitator where they can feed them a more specialized diet, keep them from getting habituated to humans, and then hopefully with the goal of release if they're uninjured. Where you're at now, I think it's a matter of either letting nature take its course or perhaps calling a rehabilitator and ask if they have any other advice for you. But I think that's a really tough situation we're in now because of that habituation. They're used to that area, humans providing some food for them, and obviously not being accepted by others of the same species.
Yeah, there you go, David. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, with your own wildlife question. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. If you're thinking about animals that might be really orphaned, what might be the signs to look for in a, let's say, a squirrel or maybe a rabbit?
Yeah, so I also want to just mention that, again, on the DNR's website, the Keep Wildlife Wild, you can get to a directory of wildlife rehabilitators. And so if you go to the website, there's also like dichotomous keys or a decision tree on what to do if you find a baby bird or what to do if I find a baby mammal. And so you can walk through that a little bit too, so that we're not adding additional workload on the wildlife rehabilitators. But if you are, you've worked through that and you know they need help, then you can use the directory on the website to locate a rehabilitator in your county. And so if you, for instance, would see that a doe deer would get killed by a car and the fawn is standing near her body, that's an immediate, you know that fawn's going to need help, right? So that would be an opportunity to call. If you had a dog or a cat or another wild animal attack a baby bunny or other things in your yard, that would be a time to call. If the animal's bleeding, looks injured, has a broken wing, all those types of things would be reasons to call. If the animal's cold or weak, lethargic, that would be another opportunity to intervene. So those are just some of them. Others would be, you know, if there's a turtle is actually, you know, an example of this. If an animal is in a dangerous location or situation, a busy street or in a parking lot, that might be an opportunity to intervene. So in the case of turtles crossing a road, we want to be very careful and mindful to place them on the side of the road where they were headed. They're doing that for a reason. They're leaving overwintering grounds to uplands to lay eggs. And we just can't caution enough that it needs to be safe for humans to be able to pull over on the side of the road at that time and then move that turtle over. So those would be some examples, Larry.
Jamie, we might also mention that Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has a list of licensed wildlife rehabilitators. So if you are looking for a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, just Google Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wildlife rehabilitators, and that list should come up. And then you can find a list that hopefully a rehabilitator is nearby where you're located.
Yeah, it's listed by county, and it'll also indicate what species they accept. So not all wildlife rehabilitators accept all wildlife species. So you'll have to be careful to look into that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. David Drake and J.B. Knack are wildlife experts today. Questions for them? You could email us, the email address ideas@WPR.org, or give us a call at 800-642-1234. Clara Neipert is our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer and technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife in our state today with David Drake and J.B. Knack of the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Great to have them back. They come by every other month on the first Wednesday of the month to talk with us, and it's always great to have them stop by. We have, you know, before we go back to the phones, there was a recent study, kind of a fascinating study about how the COVID lockdown impacted wild animals. David, I imagine you're familiar with this study. What did the researchers find?
Yeah, this was a really interesting study. This just came out last month in the journal Nature. And typically what the common narrative during the COVID lockdown, and what we're talking about is when the world went into a what is called an anthropause, that the typical narrative is when we were all locked down in our houses and we weren't out on the landscape as much, that wildlife then became more free to move across that landscape because people were not there. And typically some earlier studies that have looked at this found generally that, and I was involved with a study that came out last year. And essentially what we found in this meta study, looking at, I forgot, it was like over 100 mammal species, is that typically animals moved greater distances and they were closer to roads when people were not on the landscape as opposed to pre-pandemic times. And so that common narrative generally was supported that as people were locked down, that wildlife became more free to move around. This study that just came out last month involved 220 researchers, 163 mammal species, and more than 5,000 camera traps worldwide. And what they found was a more nuanced study or more nuanced a message here. Generally, what they were finding is in areas that are undeveloped. So, and again, this is during the COVID lockdown. So areas that were undeveloped. So you can think about a national park or a wildland area or something like that. But areas where typically you don't have a lot of people. When the COVID lockdown went into effect and people came off of the landscape, that in those undeveloped areas, carnivores like wolves and wolverines and bobcats, mountain lions, they became much more active. And when people started returning to those areas, the animals shifted their activity patterns from being diurnal or active during the day to being active during night. So they were trying to avoid people to the extent that they possibly could. Other species that are herbivores, like deer, moose, things like that, that when people were on the landscape, they became more active the more people returned to the landscape. And although they did also shift some of their activity patterns to being more active at nighttime, that those herbivores, which are tend to be prey species by some of those larger carnivores, the herbivores were probably seeking some kind of a shelter by being closer to the human settlements or human population, human presence, because the carnivores were starting to shy away from those areas where people were starting to be active. And so it was a really interesting study that came out and a much more nuanced study showed that actually the way that animals behaved during that anthropause, which was much more varied than some of the earlier studies had suggested.
It's a really, and what are the implications of that? Are there anything we can draw from that, David?
Yeah, there are some. Some of the recommendations from that study is to think about maybe pushing or putting aside larger tracts of land and having those parcels of property or those wildland areas relatively inaccessible by human beings. So don't create roadways through there, for example, and don't make it as easy for humans to get into those parcels of property or parcels of land so that wildlife have areas that they can kind of seek out as refuge away from human beings. So that was one of the stories. The other story is that in areas where you have urbanization, you have a lot of people, that you do have animals that are urban adapted. And so trying to figure out how you can create landscapes that are suitable for both for human beings and for wildlife would be much more beneficial than a lot of times the way we lay out urban spaces right now is we build those spaces primarily to suit human beings, and then we retrofit them to suit natural resources and wildlife. And if we were able to maybe develop urban spaces with both humans and wildlife in mind at the forefront, that urban space probably would look a lot different than they currently do.
That's really interesting. Well, we have many callers online with experiences to share, often relating to our baby wildlife or wildlife in general. Let's go to Jean in Merrill, who has something for us. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm hoping you can shed some light on actually the behavior of the domesticated animal in these altercations. When I was a teen, we had a female cat that was an apex predator. She could hunt anything. And she started bringing home baby mice. And she'd bring them with a soft carry in her mouth and drop them at our feet. And we'd look at their necks and they didn't have wounds. And of course, we tried to put them in box and keep them alive. And they all died one by one. And my mother said, oh, they died of fright, something like that. Well, next thing we know, she brings home a squirrel and she couldn't eat the whole thing, a mature squirrel. And so there was a half-eaten carcass on the doorstep and some regurgitated squirrel bits. And the very later that day, she started bringing home baby squirrels. So we made this associate, we thought, okay, maybe she killed the mom and obviously tried to eat it if that was the mom. But why is she bringing the babies home to us? And then in the same summer, she actually got a woodchuck on the lawn and we watched her attack it. It outweighed her. And she fought valiantly and finally delivered the mortal wound that a cat can do if it's very agile. And the woodchuck, I tried to rescue the woodchuck, and my mother said, get away from that, it'll bite you. But it died anyway. But then a day later, she was bringing home baby woodchucks, all of them that were alive when she brought them home, but one by one they died. Why would a domesticated cat eat the mother and bring home the babies?
Wow.
Well, so a lot to talk about there, but
I was going to say the same thing, Jamie.
So Gene, it's hard to say exactly what is it, you know, what is motivating the cat to particularly do that. But I think it's pretty obvious that it's killing the mother. The mother's potentially defending the nest, so it kills the mother, and then is returning to that nest location. And bringing back individuals for some gratification that perhaps you're giving it, or just it's an indoor-outdoor cat, and that's where it brings its food back to. So I think David and I'd be remiss if we didn't mention the toll that outdoor cats take on wildlife. So over a billion animals or more. So, you know, this is kind of at the top of the hour when we were talking about keep wildlife wild and being concerned about domestic animals during baby season. This is kind of an example of that, is these animals, you know, dogs off of leash, and we've had it happen with our dogs where they come across a baby bunny nest in the yard. But to the extent possible, if we can control those pets and limit the outdoor activities, especially for cats, we can help wildlife quite a bit, you know, by doing that. So it's interesting. I think we might talk about the spring hearings later, but one of the questions in the Spring Conservation Congress hearings is about increasing the education around outdoor cats and the impact that they have on wildlife populations. So it's something that conservationists are really seeing, along with getting let out of the environment and other steps to help protect wildlife moving forward. So I think we'll see more in the media as we get through the spring hearings in terms of how that question fares.
As long as it's up, we might as well talk about those spring hearings and sort of let people in on how they might participate.
Sure. So the Department of Natural Resources and the Conservation Congress host annual spring hearings. They're held the first, I guess it wouldn't be the first Monday, but they're held a Monday in April. This year it is on April 8th. And we are kind of coming back to a blended model. Historically, prior to COVID, spring hearings were held in person in every county, our 72 counties. When COVID hit, and I think it was already starting, we were already starting to look at the opportunities for an online survey or online participation through the spring hearings. But COVID prevented us from meeting in person to go through those. We're back now with a combined effort. And so on Monday, April 8th at 6 o'clock, you can attend the annual Fish and Wildlife spring hearing process. This is where the Conservation Congress delegates are elected. And so in each county, there will be an election of two of the five open seats. So each county has five Wisconsin Conservation Congress seats available. So that takes place in person on the 8th. And then they're going to have kind of an open house where DNR staff, Conservation Congress committee members will be present to talk about and to discuss some of the questions that are part of the spring hearings this year. And then after that, you have, I believe it's about 72 hours, and then the online survey goes live. It starts at noon on Wednesday, April 10th, and runs through noon on Saturday, April 13th. That's your opportunity for public input on the various questions listed on the spring hearings this year.
And I assume to find that spot, the DNR website would have it, or?
Absolutely. So DNR website, search spring hearings. It should pop up there. You get all the locations for all of the in-person events in each county. Those are listed. In addition, you can look at all of the various advisory questions proposed by the DNR and proposed by the various committees of the Conservation Congress. So rules, fisheries, and wildlife, etc.
There we go. Some good information. More questions on that, you can certainly join in with a question or an email. Let's go to Linda in Madison next. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks. I'm calling because I'm a loon ranger up north on a lake north of Boulder Junction. And a lot of the behaviors that loons have might seem alarming to people. And actually, I've gotten calls from neighbors and people around the lake when they've seen a loon flapping or doing that penguin walk where they're racing across the lake like they are. But usually it's normal loon behavior. Maybe they're protecting their nest from another male who wants to get in that territory, or another female that would like to get in that territory. And I really want to alert people to the fact that a lot of that is seen because loons are fearful when people get too close. And especially in May, the nesting season will start, and people need to keep 250 feet away. And also, I've heard it mentioned, too, about lead. Loons and other, you know, birds of that size, especially loons, if they ingest one lead sinker, they can die a terrible, horrible death. And on the other hand, I did get a call about a loon that was swimming in circles and stayed in the same place again and again. And we had some rehabilitators come out, and indeed that loon had line over its fishing line, over its beak and on its foot. And so there are times that it might occur. But most often when you see those loon alarm calls or it's seemingly erratic behavior to us, it's quite normal behavior to loons.
Linda, thanks for calling. You're nodding in agreement there, David.
Yeah, I am. Just all good information about loons, and they will be back up here soon enough. Obviously, they're coming up from down south, and typically will spend time in our state on the northern lakes. But in the southern part of the state, you can see them as they're migrating north in the spring and south in the fall. A lot of times they'll raft up for a little bit in the southern lakes. But that's the common loon is the species that we typically have here in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, Linda, thanks again. It was good information. Charlotte in Brooksfield, we'll go to you. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello. Hey, I had a question about rabbits. I haven't really seen any in a long time. I mean, maybe, well, I seen one last year, and that was it.
So do you live in town, Charlotte?
No, I live, well, right in Brookfield, right by the graveyard. So maybe the coyotes are eating them, or I don't know.
No.
Yeah, it could be a number of things, Charlotte. Rabbits are obviously, if you're a gardener, you know they're very common or ubiquitous and can be the bane of your existence sometimes if you're a gardener. But rabbit populations can fluctuate in population size for a variety of reasons. Depends on what the habitat is like, weather conditions the previous year when they were starting to have young. It also could have to do with the predator community. As you mentioned, coyotes are one of the animals that eat rabbits, as do red fox, hawks, owls, and a variety of other things. So there's a bunch of different reasons that you may not be seeing rabbits. It also could be that the rabbit population has not changed at all in your area. It's just that your activity patterns are not lining up with the rabbit activity patterns, and you're just missing them when they're out and about on the landscape. So it could be a bunch of reasons, but I'm pretty certain the rabbit population is stable where you are. And if you don't see them regularly now, you will probably in the next year or so.
Thanks, Charlotte. Appreciate it. Amy in Verona emailed us. She says she's seeing Facebook posts about baby opossums. And the posts are saying to pick up baby opossums and get them to rehab centers if you find them alone, their mothers won't come back for them. And she wonders if, is that true or not, Jamie?
Well, I'm looking at just some life history information on possums here myself, because I don't have this memorized for every species, but from what the Keep Wildlife Wild website is saying there, that when they're about 3 to 4 inches long, the young, they start to get too large for the pouch and they start to ride on mother's back, but they're still associated with her. And it isn't until about 4 months of age, when they're about 7 to 9 inches long, that they leave, kind of separate from their mother and become independent. So I think when we're talking about young possums, the best thing to do is to kind of get an idea of that length of that young to get a feel for where it's at in its development. The other thing I would do then is step back from the situation, you know, look at where that young was, go back and do something else for a couple of hours, and then return to the area and see if that possum is there. Oftentimes with young, they start to get away from the mother a little bit and explore, but mother's instincts are to hide and, you know, avoid humans. And so eventually when we back off, they'll rejoin or reunite and go on their way.
Yeah. And when you're saying 7 inches, you're talking about the body and not the tail included.
Not including the tail. Yep,
so something a touch longer than a dollar bill.
Yep. That's a great frame of reference. Six inches for a dollar bill. Yep.
That's exactly right. Gary in Milwaukee has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Well, hello. Oops, I'm sorry. Good. Yeah, I have a question about encounters between mountain lions and people. Is it my imagination, or are the attacks on people from mountain lions becoming more frequent, both in the western United States and even here in the western part of Wisconsin? And that's my question, if you can comment on that.
Okay.
Well, I'll take a stab at that, and Jamie, pop in as you want to. So the mountain lion attacks obviously garner a lot of media attention. And with social media and 24-hour news cycles these days, it may seem like those attacks are increasing. I don't know that they necessarily are. But certainly when a mountain lion attacks a human being, that typically goes viral. And so a lot of people get to see it. So that's one issue. You know, I think the mountain lions generally are ambush hunters. So they like to stay put. And as people or prey is going by, they will jump on them. Typically, my understanding of mountain lion attacks a lot of times is it's people who are running or biking. And the idea, the thought is that a mountain lion will see that person as a prey item, and that prey item is starting to move away from them. So it elicits this chase response from the mountain lion. But I don't know that mountain lion attacks are getting any greater. We do have mountain lions that do inhabit relatively urban areas in Phoenix, Los Angeles, San Francisco, things like that. And if you consider how many people live in those areas, and the fact that mountain lions are also in those areas, the fact that we don't have more attacks is pretty amazing. And I think that's a good testament to the fact that even with large predators like mountain lions, generally speaking, that predators and people can get along in some of these more urbanized areas.
Yeah, I think those are very good points. Gary, thank you so much for calling. And you can join in. Number to call, we'll get you on pretty quickly, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Carol from Green Bay emailed us. There's a huge influx of wild turkeys in the Green Bay area. She counted 32 of them marching through her yard last week, and they march through every day. How did they become so numerous? And you know, the last couple of years, actually, hunters and others have said, you know, it feels like the population's going down a bit.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you are. There have been some studies on the turkey populations down in Missouri, I believe, and some other states like that, where they have documented that the turkey population is not being as successful from a reproductive standpoint. And so they're not getting as much recruitment back into the population to offset some of the mortality factors, be it predation, hunting, whatever the case might be. And so I think that there's some mixed information out there about turkey populations. If you look at areas like Green Bay and some of these urban areas, and it doesn't have to just be in Wisconsin, but in urban areas, turkey populations are tending to do very well, as most other wildlife species tend to do that are in those urban areas where you have increased densities of individuals, because there's so many resources available in terms of food, space, lack of predation, things of that nature. So I think it really depends on where you are. But in those urban areas like Green Bay, the turkey populations are very stable and they seem to be robust. And the other issue right now, the turkey populations are still in that flock characteristic where in the wintertime they tend to flock up. You should start to see those flocks breaking up now where the males are going to start going out and assuming territorial areas where they can start to reproduce and call in the females. And once that happens, then those flocks will disperse. The females will get bred. They'll go off on their own and raise a clutch of eggs. And then they won't flock up again until, you know, late fall, winter next year.
We have an email from PETA in Mequonago. This goes back to the earlier question about mourning doves. He spends a lot of time watching mourning doves, and it's pretty normal for the youngest one to get picked on by the others. He's seen quite a few of the with some tattered feathers, and he thinks they're just establishing a pecking order, and he thinks once the dove reaches sexual maturity, you'll be just fine. Albeit a little more gritty.
Yeah, I think that's very, very possible with that situation. So, yep.
So for that earlier couple that was worried about the mourning dove getting picked on, maybe that will change once it reaches maturity. So there we go. Nancy in Wautoma, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. So, you know, you were talking about the cats causing damage to wildlife, and I have a number of bird feeders, and I put bird houses up and everything, and I had concern over the feral cats in my area. I did get two feral cats from the barn cat program because I have a horse barn in Waupaca, but what I'm doing, I feed them. I mean, they have food in front of them all the time, so they take care of the mice in my barn and my garage. They really don't, you know, get out there. They don't need to hunt. And what I noticed this winter, because I left the barn door open a little bit for them to go in and out, is I had about three other feral cats that were coming in, and I noticed two of them had clipped ears, which is what they do for the barn cat program. Two of them had clipped ears, and I'd like to catch the other two, but we don't have a barn cat program. But my thinking is that by feeding them and having food available to them when they do get really hungry, that they'll leave my birds and the other wildlife in the area alone because they don't need to hunt them for. Obviously, their instinct will make them hunt, but I think not to the extent that they would otherwise, as long as I'm providing food.
Yeah,
so that's
well,
kind of what I'm trying to do to help my wildlife in this area.
Yeah, Nancy, thanks. Jamie, what do you think?
Sure. And it, you know, it can be really hard to find that balance. And I think, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't acknowledge the benefit that cats on farms do have. But if you have the ability to get them neutered or spayed, that's certainly helpful because we don't want to have more than we need, right? And I know you're attempting to do that. I can't really point to any research that I'm aware of where it looks at feral cats or barn cats that are fed and they're, you know, whether they continue to hunt, if they continue to hunt at similar levels and outside the barn, certainly barn cats, it's not uncommon to see them a mile from the barn itself. So, but I just can't point to any research that I'm aware of where it's looking at fed outdoor cats versus non-supplemented.
Yeah, the other thing I'll just mention quickly, Larry, is I agree with Jamie. I think keep the cats indoors. I know we're talking about feral cats here, which is a little bit different than a domesticated pet cat. But, you know, to the extent you can, keep all cats indoors. It's healthier for the cat, for one thing. It's certainly healthier for the wildlife community. But the other issue about feeding cats like that is you do have the potential to draw in other species of wildlife. So you may, and you may not be aware of it, but as you're putting pet food out on the landscape, you may be drawing in raccoons and possum and skunk and other animals like that that you don't necessarily want in that area, because they'll start to get used to or habituate to human beings. And then other issues can start happening. Disease transmission can start happening between humans and wildlife, wildlife and other domesticated animals. Increased aggression from those wildlife species could occur if they're not receiving food and they're used to receiving food. So it's just better if you don't feed animals outside, period. And again, if you with the cats, if you can just keep as many of the cats indoors as possible, that would be best for the cats and the wildlife.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today from UW Extension and from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller on Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of wildlife on the program today with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online and emails as well. Let's go to Jim in Phillips, Wisconsin. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a transport driver for Northwoods Wildlife Center. And your information on cats or disrupting animals out in the wild is pretty accurate, because over half of the small animals I get are injured by cats.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jim. Thanks for reconfirming that. But also, thanks for your time in driving those animals, too. So I appreciate the work that you do.
All right. Thanks so much, Jim. Kathleen in Winchester, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Larry, for taking my call. I have a funny story about our cat. We inherited one that kept wanting to go out all the time, but we wanted to keep him in. He would get out, and we'd hear all of a sudden on the porch a thump, thump. We'd race to rescue whatever he brought. He never brought a dead animal. He never killed them. He wanted to play with them. And so he'd swat them until they hit the wall. And we'd rescue them and take them out, wait till they recovered, and off they'd scamper or fly. And the second story is we knew a friend who rescued raccoon babies in the nest out of chimneys. They tried to make them go back to the mother, get the mother to come back and get them. That never worked. They tried everything. So we had five families of raccoons living with our boys and one girl, and they used to walk around with raccoon fur pieces around their necks. They were absolutely the cleanest animals I've ever known, never made a mess of the house. We left them in a cage that they couldn't get out of until they were old enough to escape from a predator. And then we lived with them in the summer, and they'd just come back for dinner. They'd go scampering off.
So, what? Kathleen, great stories. And I think those are stories of, you know, that a lot of people can relate to. It was not uncommon to do and take raccoons in or other wildlife in. We're really trying to make the shift away from that. Raccoons, I would not want my kids playing with raccoons. They carry so many diseases, from roundworm to distemper and things that can, you know, infect your domestic animals, but also not something you want introduced into if you have a farm or into your home either. But again, we're really looking at this in terms of what's in the best interest of the animal, not necessarily what's in our best interest that, you know, we want to have these cute little raccoons around the house. So again, the animal is best served to be left in the wild. In the case of the chimney, with the litter in the chimney, there are certainly things you can try. I can appreciate it. It's not always 100% successful, but oftentimes you're able to capture the mother with the young and then relocate or remove them together. There's other ways. If you've got raccoons in an attic where you can put on talk radio, you can put on the Larry Mueller show. They don't like talk radio. and you keep a light on, or use ammonia soaked rags just for the deterrent from the scent, the smell. And oftentimes you can get that raccoon to move her kits to another location. It's not uncommon for them to move den locations. So there's other ways that we can, you know, try to encourage them to move on, but still stay together and stay in the wild.
I was just going to add really quick, raccoons in chimneys is a very common thing because raccoons typically will nest in cavities, and your chimney is essentially an artificial cavity for a raccoon. So if you do not already have a chimney cap on your chimney, please get one and have it installed if you can't do it yourself. But that's a super easy way to keep raccoons out of your chimney. And the chimney cap costs maybe $150, but it will cost you at least that much, if not more, to have somebody come in and extract those raccoons from your chimney if you don't already have a chimney cap on it.
Mark in Sussex, will go to you. Hi, Mark.
Great show as usual.
Thank you.
So I was reading an article in the CBC, the Canadian National Broadcasting and documentary part of it, and they were saying there's a cat collar. It's a multicolored collar. A friend of mine called it a clown collar. And it was the person who had a cat and wanted to leave it outside said it didn't bring a single bird home after putting that collar on. It brought home, you know, mammals, rodents, chipmunks. But because the birds can see colors, he said it greatly reduced their depredation. I don't know how you'd put that on a feral cat, though.
Yeah. Have you heard of that, Jamie?
I have not heard of the colored collar, but there is a number of research studies where they have put bells on mm-hmm. cats, and essentially they are not effective. So I'm not, you know, if that is helping with the birds, that would be great. It'd be better than nothing. But I just think about how stealthy some of these yeah. cats can be that I'm not sure. I would still reason that you would still pick off a bird from time to time, even with that color.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Mark, thank you.
It might reduce the efficiency a little bit.
Rona and Cameron will go to you. Hi, Rona.
Hi, Larry. Hello to your guests. This morning, a friend of mine shared a photo on Facebook, which I know to be a true photo. Anyway, it was a photo of wild turkeys, and the hen turkey definitely had some type of a disease. Her head, it looked like she had, almost some kind of a fungus or mold kind of stuff growing on her head. And I'm wondering if there's been any reports. I'm in northwest Wisconsin in Barron County. I'm wondering if there's any reports of, is it fowl pox or is that transmissible to turkeys or
yeah.
what could be going on with this bird?
David, do you know anything about that?
It could be a variety of things, and who knows exactly what. It could be something that's somewhat natural that the bird, it has warts, is just born with it. It could have a loss of feathers on his head for some natural reason. But I think what I would suggest you do, if you're curious about that, is call your county agent, the county biologist in Barron County for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And you can find that by just Googling Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Barron County, and call them up and ask them and report what you're seeing and ask them if they're seeing it in other places. But that might be a good way to see if the county biologist is aware of it, then they can say, yeah, we're seeing this, and they may have a better idea about what exactly it is. If they're not aware of it, then you can make them aware of it. As if they start getting other calls, then perhaps they'd want to report that to one of the state veterinarians for the DNR and perhaps start to monitor if there's a potential disease issue.
Yeah, and if you've got a good photo like that, share that photo with the biologist, or if you want to send it to David or I too, I'd be happy to forward it on and loop in the wildlife vet and get their interpretation.
Rona, there you go. Thank you so much. We had someone sent us an email picture, Mary in Milwaukee. She lives in a residential area of Milwaukee adjacent to a 40-acre woods. Something's been digging in her slightly sloped side yard. Any ideas on what or why? Can she prevent this from continuing or happening again?
Yes.
It's
well,
pretty dug up.
It is pretty dug up, but it looks like it's raccoons. There's a number of animals that will tear up your yard, almost look like somebody's taking a rototiller to your yard, and potentially it could be skunks, raccoons, fox, occasionally coyotes would do that. But in this instance, it looks like raccoons, and likely what they're doing is they are tearing up the turf to get to the soil, because there's likely invertebrates, grubs and things like that in the soil that they're looking at as a food source. So a couple of things you can do to prevent that from happening. You can put a grubicide, introduce a grubicide into your soil to reduce the number of grubs in there. You could also, in that type of an area, put down something like chicken wire, where you'd stake the chicken wire down so that you prevent the raccoons from continuing to disturb the soil or the turf, excuse me, and then replant some seed once we get into a warmer season here into the growing season.
There we go. Thanks so much for that photo and for that email. And you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. And we have some emails to deal with, too. But you can do it, too. Just email to ideas@wpr.org. David Drake and Jamie Nack are guests today, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Looking at the world of wildlife today on the program, Larry Mueller here with my guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the University of Wisconsin Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, we go to you. Thank you for calling, Pat. What's on your mind?
Hi. We live on a really busy street. And in 2020, I think it was, the street was closed for repair. So only the neighbors could drive through. And that summer, we had birds like cedar waxwings, cardinals, robins, and our neighbor had mourning doves. All of those nested in our front yard. They built their nests there. And then in the fall, when the leaves fell, there's a fence that divides the yards. There was a little tiny cute nest that had been built on top of the fence. Well, I have a lot of vines growing there, so it was kind of hidden. And that has never happened before. And I just thought maybe because the street was so quiet that those birds felt more at home and less stressed. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was neat.
I'm sorry, Larry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great story. There are studies in literature that demonstrate birds will, for example, nest further off of a trail that hikers use, that might be a busy trail that hikers use and things like that. So it is possible that what you saw in 2020 is true. The species you listed, however, are very, very common species in urban areas, and typically those types of species adapt quite quickly to living around human beings and the disturbances that are associated with human beings. So it is also possible that they are nesting in your yard. You just may not have noticed that, or they might be nesting in your yard in areas that you may not easily be able to see. So, but what I would maybe challenge you to do this spring is to go out and survey your yard and see if you can't find those types of nests again. And you may be surprised to see them out there, even once the busy traffic has returned to that road.
Yeah. Pat, thank you for calling. David in Maple, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, David.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm seeing a lot of damage to young sugar maple trees, the bark being taken off, and I guess either squirrels or porcupines. And actually, I've seen porcupine tracks. Do you have any ideas about control or deterrence?
Yeah, so go on, Jamie.
No, I was going to say I can go first, but David, please chime in. So, David, I think you're correct in terms of thinking towards tree squirrels and porcupine. And what I was going to suggest, you know, there's not a lot of repellents that are necessarily going to be effective in this situation. I think probably the best is to mechanically or to exclude, use fencing to protect those trees. So whether it's, I don't know how many trees we're dealing with, but if it is a manageable number, to wrap them in hardware cloth, we still want the airflow. You could also create or place a baffle, make one that's large enough for the diameter of the tree to prevent squirrels from going up that tree if they're causing damage higher up. But otherwise, especially with the porcupine, if there's a way to completely eliminate its access to the area where they have been causing damage. And I'll throw it to David if he has some other thoughts.
Yeah, I think those are all good suggestions. The other thing I might add on is, depending, as Jamie said, depending on the number of trees that are being damaged, if it's tolerable damage or if you're willing to tolerate the amount of damage, doing nothing is a viable option for sure, especially with squirrels, because squirrels are so common that it can be really difficult to actually manage squirrels as they start stripping bark off of the trees. The other thing that I would suggest is if it's on property that you own and you're legal to do so and you're willing and able to do so, another option is a lethal option, and that would be to shoot squirrels and porcupines that you see on your property. But again, make sure that you're able to legally discharge a firearm or a bow and arrow where you live. Both of the species you're talking about, squirrels and porcupines, are not protected, and you are able to lethally remove them on property that you own at time damage is occurring. So that might be an option. Not everybody is in favor of lethal management, but if that's something that you are willing to pursue and the damage is beyond what your tolerance level is, that might be an option you want to think about as well.
Yeah. David, thank you for calling. Let's go to John in Rhinelander. Hi, John.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is mainly probably about squirrels in fireplaces, but I think it could work for other larger animals as well. I've seen tons of dead ones inside fireplaces. Sometimes they get down there, but they cannot get back out. What I've done in the past is I've got a long tree branch. This was on a one-story, one example. And I was able to get it down far enough and left, came back the next day, the squirrel was out. So I wonder if that may work for a little bit larger animals as well, because some of them get in there and they just can't get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Some of them get in there and they don't want to get out also, because it's a pretty nice place to be. But it does depend on what the flue is like. And if you have one of those ceramic flues in there, that can be a pretty slippery surface that is difficult for those animals to get out. And if the flue is open, they may actually come into your house, because they'll follow gravity down if they can get into your house. Again, the better thing to do is, if you do not already have a chimney cap in your chimney, I would go and buy one and have it installed if you can't do that yourself. But that is the easiest solution to keep animals out of your chimney.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, John. Dan in Wisconsin Dells, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello there, Larry and guests. The question I have is, I know when there's a large rabbit population, because the foxes have declined, and then the next year it seems like all the rabbits are gone, but the foxes have increased. I've been seeing a lot of dead skunks on the side of the road. Do they populate just like rabbits do?
Not as prolifically. So I don't know if they have, I don't think they have multiple litters like rabbits do. I mean, the young can be 6 months old and they are capable of having a litter themselves. So they're not as prolific as what a rabbit would be. But when you noticed all of those skunks, I'm guessing it was in the last month or so. And what we're seeing is those animals coming out of, they're not a true hibernator, but they den up in the winter. And when we had all of that warm weather, I too noticed a number of skunks. And I think it was more related to their activity levels increasing in the spring there.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Lisa emailed us. She attends Marquette Law School, and any given day she can walk around the building, Eckstein Hall, and find birds that died hitting the law school's grand windows, even including a woodcock. that she rushed to the rehab center, but it ultimately died. She reached out to the law school, was ignored by the dean, and eventually she got the message through to building management. But when she checked to see if there were any moves to mitigate damage the windows are causing, none have been made, and she was told there are no plans. Any ideas of what else she could do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right now, we are starting to get into the beginning of spring migration, so we're going to have a large influx of birds coming up for the next month to 2 months, something like that. And bird strikes on windows is very, very common. We've talked about it on this program, about a program we have going on here in Madison between our department and the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, which used to be Madison Audubon, and some other partners surveying buildings that have large glass surface areas, and to examine the extent of this issue. For the issue talked about in Marquette, the one thing to do is if they can frit the glass or put some kind of decals on the glass just to break up that reflection. And it could be, you know, you can buy decals through Wild Birds Unlimited, for example, or to go online and buy decals you can put on those windows just to break that reflection up. If those windows have curtains or blinds, if they can lower the blinds or shut the curtains during the day so that the birds can't see in as much, and at night, if they can shut the lights off when the birds are migrating during the evening, that would also help somewhat to the extent possible. But there are some strategies. There's other strategies, and what I would suggest is maybe for the caller to go to the American Bird Conservancy. And the American Bird Conservancy has a great resource page on how to reduce or eliminate bird strikes with windows.
Might also get the Milwaukee Audubon folks involved in that, as a, you know, there you've got a larger group of people that might be able to help not only educate, but apply a little pressure as well.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Vivian in Green Bay emailed us, or she called but couldn't stay with us. She helped a possum who was so cold he couldn't move out of the middle of a busy city street. She'd like to stress that when helping wild animals, you shouldn't interfere too much.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about this with the turtle crossing the road, but, you know, human safety has to come first. It actually, hearing the possum, it reminds me of another thing to mention to listeners, but another place that animals often become stranded is in window wells.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're walking around the foundation of your home, if you have egress windows, and animals can fall into that. And possum, I remember it because I rescued a possum in one at one point in time. But other things are amphibians, from salamanders to frogs and toads, often fall in there. So that would be another way you could help wildlife around the home, is by covering those, protecting those, or at a bare minimum, leaving a ramp in them mm-hmm. so animals can get back out.
Yeah.
And the ramp could just be something as simple as a piece of 2x4.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. Linda in McHenry, Illinois, emailed us. She has an issue with raccoons using the section of her roof as their outhouse. She's tried washing the poop away and applying ammonia with mixed results. She has checked in her attic, and there are no critters living inside. She does see the raccoons eating at her bird feeder at night. She's also tried putting up a motion light detector on the roof, but that does not seem to deter them either. Any suggestions? What do you think?
Go on, Jamie.
I'll jump in. So I think the first thing to do is to figure out their access point. So how are they getting up to that attic? If it's from a tree and a limb that's going over, it might be in the best interest to remove that limb to remove the access. If they're crawling up the side of the house, you know, how can we eliminate access to the roof would be, you know, a long-term solution in that case. So I think that's really where I would start.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. The other suggestion I would say right now, you want to be a little bit careful if the temperatures start dropping below 32 degrees Fahrenheit so that your water doesn't freeze. But you can also maybe think about installing a motion-activated sprinkler up on your roof. If the light isn't working, maybe the sprinkler would work, so that as the animals are coming up there, they get hit with the water from the sprinkler as they break that motion barrier. and that might help as well. But I think Jamie's strategy is the first strategy I would start with, and then move on to something else.
And Larry, if I could just make a quick point too, you know, if you've been listening to the show, you know, David and I really haven't talked about trapping wildlife and moving wildlife. That, you know, it's kind of a temporary solution. It doesn't really cause the problem. But I also want to remind people that with this being baby animal season, you want to be really, really careful about trapping adults in the, and then abandoning or orphaning their young. So it's not the best time of the year to be doing that. And often it isn't the long-term solution to the problem.
Yeah. Katie emailed us. She has a walkout basement and they spend a lot of time there. For 2 years in a row, the crows have destroyed the screens on her basement windows and they pound on the window panes. She put up scare tape, owl statues, you name it. It works for a day or two, and then they get wise. If they don't like the windows, they sit in the yard and scream, help.
Yeah, they're obviously probably seeing their reflection in the window, and that's what's they're going after, the bird that they see in the window, which is that bird. So I think if this is a seasonal problem or an issue that happens for a short period of time, I think the easiest thing is to take your screens down. And again, if you have curtains or blinds that you can draw on those windows so you can cut the reflection, that would be preferable. The other issue is you may have to get a little bit more aggressive with the harassment device and not necessarily use an owl decoy or scare tape, but use something a little bit more motion activated, for example, or when you actually see the crows out there, you may have to physically go out there and scare them out of the yard and just continually do that until they realize that this isn't a very very good place, or I'm not welcome in this area.
Ellen emailed us, I hope you've had a chance to look at it, with a picture of a deer in their neighborhood in Eau Claire County, and it appears to have a growth on its face.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took a look at it too, and I'm not sure if it's, to me, it almost looks like an injury, and I apologize that listeners can't see it, but to me, it looks like something pierced that side of her, and that what's going on is a big abscess as a result of the injury. It doesn't look like a fibroma or, you know, some of the other diseases we've seen.
Yeah, because there's something also hanging off of the deer's face on the side. Yeah. So I would agree with you, Jamie, that it does look like there's more of an injury relative to some kind of a tumor. But yeah, that's very interesting. But it certainly doesn't look like the deer is any worse
for
the
wear. Healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks healthy enough otherwise, yeah, for sure. Yeah. David and Phillips, what's on your mind?
I wondered if it's allowable to trap beavers. I'm not a trapper, but I see it being done in the national forest. Is this allowable or is this right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yes, you are. Well, it depends on who you are, but yes, beaver trapping is legal in the state of Wisconsin. There is a beaver season that recreational trappers can participate in. That typically occurs in the wintertime when the pelt is prime or in its best condition, if you are interested in selling that fur. But there is a lot of trapping for nuisance reasons throughout the year, and there's a lot of trapping. Typically, it's done by government trappers with the USDA Wildlife Services, which is a federal agency. But they will trap beavers throughout the year to protect trout streams, for example, to reduce the amount of flooding over roadways where beavers may have dammed up a culvert going under a roadway. They may trap beavers to reduce flooding on timberland, agricultural land, things like that. So beaver trapping is quite common, and it's very active throughout the year here in Wisconsin.
David, you recently developed a website and Facebook page called the Urban Wildlife Project. What are some of the resources on the sites for urban and suburban residents?
Yeah, this is a website that Jamie and I developed, and we've worked with some colleagues through the Urban Wildlife Institute at the Lincoln Park Zoo down in Chicago. But essentially, this is a website that we are trying to create as a clearinghouse for, in particular, residential homeowners and renters or people who live in urban suburban areas, so they get an understanding about the types of urban wildlife that might be in those urban areas living amongst human beings, why wildlife are in urban areas, the different types of urban, suburban areas, things that you can do to support wildlife. So creating, enhancing, and managing wildlife habitat that would support urban wildlife. And when we're talking about supporting and attracting wildlife, we're not necessarily talking about attracting more raccoons or rabbits to your yard, but we're talking about promoting habitat or developing habitat that would support migratory songbirds. So as they fly through our area, if they need some habitat to stop over and refuel as they migrate further north in the spring or further south in the fall, perhaps create habitat that birds can take advantage of for breeding purposes, for nesting purposes, but also attracting species that normally may not be in urban areas, such as some salamander species or some other reptile amphibian type species, things like that, that animals that you would not normally find in urban areas because that habitat's not there. But if you can develop the habitat, perhaps you can start to increase the biodiversity of species in those urban areas. And that's what this website has been dedicated to try to do.
And how do we find that website?
Good point, Larry. That's if you go to urbanwildlifeproject.wisc.edu, it should pop right up. So urbanwildlifeproject.wisc.edu.
And I'm sure we'll have that posted on today's program, ideas@wpr.org/Larry. And Clara Neipert says, hey, we already got it up, Larry. So
awesome.
She
thank
just
you, Clara.
Shot me a note to that effect. So there you go. We're certainly appreciative of that. And I want to thank you both for being with us today. We covered a lot of ground, got a lot done, and I appreciate it. And we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie Nack, also a member of the Forest and Wildlife Department. And an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. But great to have both of them with us. And we will have them back once again. I just want to take an extra minute because today's Trina LaSousa's last day as our technical director. She is about to become a mom, a new mom, and we're really excited for her. Trina, we're looking forward to seeing your new little guy, and we want to thank you for all you've done for us on the show, your time here. It's always been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And we're looking forward to seeing that little one, and you're going to be a great mom. I'm sure of that. Trina LaSousa, our technical director, is about to become a mom. So there you go. And we're excited about that happening. And it'll be happening relatively soon, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, boy. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, the representatives from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection return to tell you how to protect your personal information and safeguard you against scams. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mietler.